Hey guys, welcome to the Tipsy Archives. I'm your host, Rachel Leagy, and in today's episode, my friend Aaron Redekop and I are going to be discussing an unsolved murder that became a media sensation in the 1920s in Vancouver. So it was pretty awesome that we got to talk about some local history, which is definitely something we would like to do more of in the future. This case, which became known as the Scottish Nightingale, is steeped in racism, police corruption, high society, cover-ups, kidnapping, and potentially even drug trade. So I hope you guys enjoy.
Okay, did I tell you about how I came across this story?
No.
So last year when I was in school, as you probably know, I am a hardcore insomniac.
Yes.
And one night it was about 5 a.m. and I just said, screw it, I'm not going to try and sleep anymore. And I got up. And I went and worked on my computer, and my partner and I live close to the Mountain View Cemetery in Vancouver, which is, I believe, the only actual cemetery in Vancouver?
Yeah, in the city of Vancouver, I think so.
It's quite huge.
Yeah.
It's at least 10 blocks long. And I was Googling it and looking it up because I have a relative in there that I can't find.
Okay.
And so I was just kind of looking through the Wikipedia page and scrolling through important people who'd been buried in Mountain View Cemetery. And the name, the Scottish Nightingale, caught my eye because, you know, it's intriguing.
Yeah.
So I ended up looking up a news story, and I'm sitting there, like, you know, 6 a.m. in the morning, no sleep, getting, like, going down the rabbit hole of essentially this, this story of an unsolved murder from the 1920s in Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as you found out through your research, it's pretty, there's a lot of corruption, and it's
a fascinating story.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. As soon as you sent it over to me, I actually, cause I'd never heard about it before at all. And the more I dived into, to research on this, I was just hooked on it, and I was so excited to get to talk about it, because it's fascinating.
But it's funny, too, because when my partner eventually woke up, I was just like, listen to this, and started telling him all about the story. So, basically, what happened was, I believe it was July of 1924.
Yeah, July 26th, 1924.
In the middle of a swelteringly hot summer, the body of Janet Smith was found in the downstairs of the home that she was working in. She had a gunshot wound to the head, a revolver laying near her.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously she was found by her coworker, who was what, you know, they referred to in that day as a Chinese houseboy.
Yeah.
And the police came in and surveyed the scene. I think there was a, you know, an ironing board near her.
Yeah, there was an ironing board. She had some suspicious black marks on her thumb.
Hmm.
She had a burn mark, I believe. And then her head was also bashed in.
But they don't concentrate on that right off the bat.
Nope. They don't. Not at all.
No.
Nope.
The police come in. The coroner comes in. They very quickly assess the scene, take her to the morgue. They say this is suicide.
Yeah.
You know, obviously they talked to the family she works for. This is Fred and Doreen Baker.
Yeah.
And they say, obviously this is suicide. Take her to the morgue. She's embalmed. She is buried. And initially, that's it.
Yeah. Well, and I've read somewhere that it might have been a miscommunication that led her to be embalmed and that she wasn't supposed to be, but there wasn't a lot of support for that in anything that I read. And also I kind of feel like if somebody came in with all of this like sort of suspicious death, then I was a mortician, I'm not pretending to be an expert, I would be like, maybe I shouldn't embalm this person.
Yeah, on a side note, I actually have no idea how much of a say a mortician has in that, or if they would just be completely based on what the police said.
Yeah.
You need to do that. Because there was no autopsy.
There was no autopsy, mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, maybe but I think I would clarify that I was supposed to embalm this person, rather mm-hmm. than just...
Understanding, it seemed like they were instructed that that's what should happen.
Yeah.
A couple weeks goes by, and this girl, Janet Smith, she is originally born in Scotland.
Yes,
she met the Bakers in Europe. They were using her as a nanny, and then she came back over to Vancouver with them.
Yeah.
And, so that's one thing I should have said at the top of the at the podcast was I was excited to do this topic because every once in a while I definitely want to focus on something to do with local history.
Yeah.
And, of course, we live here in Vancouver, British Columbia. So the story gave us a pretty cool chance to do that and to kind of also dig into some of the not-so-great parts of Vancouver's history as well.
Yeah.
Of the some of the racial tension that happened throughout the building of British Columbia and so on.
And also it's interesting to look at sort of the history of corruption in our police force,
yes,
too, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of really dark periods in the history of Vancouver policing, and this is definitely one of them.
They don't seem to shy away from it too much now.
No.
As far as talking about it.
Well, even, so we have a police museum here in Vancouver. It's down in the downtown east side. And it actually highlights the elements of police corruption that have happened over the years in Vancouver. Because I think, not that they're proud of that history, but I mm-hmm. think they're quite proud of what they've done to overcome that corruption. And while there's always going to be issues with any police force, Vancouver's really, really focused on making sure that there's a lot of transparency, and it's a far more transparent police force than many of the other ones around the country and around the world.
I've heard that museum is great.
Oh, it's my favorite.
And I haven't been, but I also thought it would be a great idea for us at some point to do one of their tours on Prohibition or something like
yeah.
that, and then maybe report on it and report on that.
There are some great things in that museum, and I think that would be a fabulous idea. And then we can go to Prohibition, the bar.
Yeah, totally. So, getting back to the story.
Yeah, so Janet, since she was also the one other thing, I don't know if you mentioned this, she's only 23 years old when she dies.
Yeah.
So she's very young, and she's away from home, she's in a new country, so just important things to keep in mind.
I suppose some people that knew her, I mean, she must have known some people with the Scottish Society, they didn't buy the suicide story at all.
No, she had a number of friends who were also nannies from Scotland, and they just did not believe that their friend could have committed suicide. Mm-hmm. They were adamant that she hadn't, and so they went and actually took the case to a Scottish reverend who lived in East Vancouver and said that there was absolutely no way she committed suicide, that she was afraid.
And that they were outraged that they had just closed it and buried her so quickly.
Exactly.
So they, eventually somehow they got pressure on the Attorney General, who okayed her being exhumed and reinvestigated. But at this point, she's been buried and she's been embalmed, so they can't get any kind of, sexual evidence off of her to know if there'd been anything foul play in that regard.
Yeah.
And really, I mean, I'm sure, like, in the embalming and burying process, you probably get washed and all that. So there's nothing for them to find.
Even with today's technology, I'm not sure how much information you would be able to get out of an embalmed body.
Well, I shouldn't say nothing, because this is where they do focus on, there's also a wound in the back of her head.
Yeah.
So, at that point, they finally have to admit, okay, obviously, like, this can't be suicide. This girl's been hit in the back of the head and then, I guess, shot in the side of the head.
Yeah.
And has these other, sort of defensive burns or marks on her hands. So, at this point, it does become a murder case.
Now we've got to do something about it.
So, there aren't any clear suspects. So at this point in the case, the suspicions turn to the person that discovered the body.
As they always do.
Yeah. I believe his name was Wong Fong Sing. We'll call him Wong. So it's believed that Wong had some affections towards Janet.
Yes. So her nanny friend, the one that went to go and talk to the Scottish reverend, told him that Wong had been giving her, or had given Janet Smith a number of gifts, mm-hmm. including a silk nightgown. So not just like any gift that you give somebody.
I didn't come across this in my research, but I'd be curious to know if they actually found that at all.
Yeah.
Or if it was just like a rumored thing that had happened.
Yeah, because it seems like a lot of this case was based in rumor and not in actual fact.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of hearsay. I also saw information saying that Wong was married or engaged.
Yes.
I don't know whether his wife was in Vancouver or in China still.
Yeah, there was a lot of issues with Chinese immigration.
Yeah.
At this time, it was only...
So, I mean, it was really easy for the people involved in the case, you know, the general public of Vancouver. I mean, at this point, the media is really picking this up. And that was one thing about this case, is that it was a real media storm at the time. And it really started to capture the imagination of people. And there was some really tense racial issues going on between, the white community and the Chinese community. Which, you know, if you don't know much about your BC history, a lot of Chinese workers were brought over to work on the railroads, probably to do other kinds of labor work. They made it really easy for people to come over and promise them money, paid them terrible wages, treated them terribly. Many, many, Chinese workers were killed during this period of time working on the railroads. And then once, they sort of started to settle their communities within Vancouver and around BC, they started to make immigration much, much harder.
Yeah, so in 1885, the Canadian Parliament passed the Chinese Immigration Act, and so the goal of that was to discourage Chinese people from entering Canada, because we essentially, according to the government at the time, no longer needed them to complete the railroad. And so they started inputting a tax, and it started at about $50 per head, and it would go up every sort of 5 to 7 years until it maxed out at $500. Mm-hmm. And then in 1923, we actually passed the Chinese Immigration Act of 1923, and that actually banned all Chinese immigration unless you were a business person, a clergy, an educator, or a student.
So this is basically what, that year or the year before?
Yeah, it's right around the exact same time.
So a lot of these, these Chinese guys had come over and with the intention of bringing their families over and then just absolutely couldn't. And there was a lot of tension in the community. So I think, you know, a lot of racism and a lot of misunderstanding. So it was really easy for the Vancouver community to point the finger at somebody like Wong.
Exactly. And even, say, Wong had been friendly towards her just in a friendship sense, that could have easily had been misinterpreted as something more given the times.
So at one point they interview one of her friends. Did you say this already?
Yeah, so, well, one of her friends goes to talk to this reverend. So her friend goes to see him.
The same reverend that's involved with the Scottish Society?
Yeah, but then they do interview. I'm not sure if it's the same friend or not.
One of her Scottish nanny friends.
Yeah.
And she claims to that Janet's been scared of this guy.
Yeah, that she was a good girl and she lived in fear of him.
But also there's contradicting evidence because Janet had a journal.
Yes.
That kind of paints her as sort of enjoying the attention of men.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's verses in there about being lonely and wishing that she had men to hold, you know, hold her in their arms. Which, of course, like, we're not slut-shaming.
Oh, no, there's no judgment.
There's no judgment at all.
Yeah.
But, it doesn't really paint her as being afraid of men or being afraid of Wong.
No, and it doesn't paint somebody who is also unaware of the effect that they have on men either. And so it seems like she was a girl who recognized her own sexuality and recognized the potential impacts of that.
But at this time, there are some people involved in the, you know, prominent newspapers in Vancouver who are very anti-Asian, printing stories about how obviously it must be him. At this point, or actually probably way later after the case, because of the case, that lawyer you were talking about, whose name I don't remember.
The MLA, you mean?
Yeah, the MLA. She starts trying to push through that bill.
Yeah, so she wants to introduce legislation that will prohibit employers from hiring white women and Asians to be servants within the same households. And actually just to sort of exemplify the racism that is attached to that, it actually didn't even refer to them. It referred to saying hiring white women and Orientals as servants.
Right.
So it really goes back to the racial words.
Wow, it's crazy to think that that's less than 100 years ago.
It's so crazy.
Yeah.
And when you think about, so the reason, like the language that surrounds race in that documentation is really almost barbaric.
Yes.
They start talking about racial biology, and they're talking about how Asians and Europeans probably didn't have the biological capacity to intermarry or reproduce, and they talk about the brown and yellow inhabitants of Asia and how they're going to cause the downward economic evolution, and it's just crazy racism.
Yeah,
in
there. Such bigotry.
It would not be a time in which I would want to live.
No, and the bill was not passed.
No, it is. No. It is voted down.
But you know, this MLA was trying to use the case to make that happen.
And there was significant support for it, too.
Yeah,
even though it doesn't pass, there is significant support for it.
So, Wong goes to trial.
Yes.
And they just can't find enough evidence. In my opinion, from what I've read, I don't think he did it.
I don't think he did it either, because it seems too much of a cover-up. And
absolutely.
There's no reason, like, given the apparent racism that was happening at this time, there is no reason why you would have a cover-up to protect somebody that you are going to villainize.
Yeah, because if we look back on how they treated the case initially, it seems very much like the police were able to sort of handle that case in a way that was favorable to someone.
Yes.
And if it had been Wong, that would not have happened.
No, there's absolutely no reason why they would have. Like, the only thing that I could come up with for it being him and having sort of this cover-up is based on the idea that at that time, society sort of viewed having the police come into your home as something that only happened in lower society. And so I used to read a lot of novels by Anne Perry that are set in the Victorian era in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But you're essentially shunned if the police have to come to your home.
Yeah, because we haven't really talked about the fact that this happened in a really upper-class neighborhood.
Yeah, it is a very wealthy neighborhood, and it is predominantly European, like white European society that live there. They are upper class. The bakers are high society. They're related to a number of like high flying individuals at that time, including the people who live in Highcroft Manor, which is this like big old manor house in Vancouver. That's a really big, prominent feature in our history.
So we have the contrast of, these Chinese workers with these high society people in Vancouver, or as you pointed out earlier, Point Grey.
Mm-hmm.
And these areas are still very nice today.
Well, there are very affluent neighborhoods in Canada or in Vancouver.
So after a few months of, the case becoming a big buzz in the media, and the suspicion has fallen on Wong.
Yeah, and there's a lot of pressure from the Scottish society that it is him. And one important thing to note is that at this time, Vancouver and Point Grey is a very Scottish, there's a high Scottish population in Vancouver at this time. And so they're able to put significant pressure on on the police force. And
it seems like at this point, like, it's been a lot of speculation, a lot of sort of gathering evidence, a lot of newspaper reports, but not a lot of legal action has really happened.
Nope. So far, there's been none in terms of the case.
Mm-hmm. Just investigation not turning up a lot of information.
Exactly. So then in the frustration, the Scottish Society essentially, or people involved in the Scottish Society, decide to take action into their own hands. And so they're a group of men who are dressed in Ku Klux Klan robes.
It's not the Scottish Society that kidnaps them.
No, it's the KKK that kidnaps them, isn't it? But it's but it's because of pressure that got put on them from the Scottish Society, isn't it?
No.
Really?
No.
Okay, so that is really interesting.
Because it's not the KKK at all. You know that that's just a cover.
It's just people dressed as KKK. Yeah.
It has nothing to do with them. Okay, yeah. So Wong is kidnapped, like, months later.
Yeah.
By men dressed in KKK robes.
Yeah.
And he is, and this has, as far as I'm concerned, I have researched, nothing to do with the Scottish Society.
Oh, interesting.
It is,
I think I just jumped to that conclusion.
Yeah, no, because it turns out to be members of the police force.
Yes.
Yes.
That is very true.
And, yeah, I mean, maybe. I just didn't really see anything that really pointed to that being the case. I assumed that, because basically what this is all coming around to, which we haven't quite touched on yet, is that the police are in on this. Like, there's something really fucking shady going on with the cops.
Oh, yeah, it's hugely shady.
So somebody important, whether it's a high society member or a member of the police force, wants this guy to take the fall.
Yeah.
Wong.
Yeah, and it's easy to do it because there is such racial bigotry towards Chinese workers.
And the reason I don't think that the Scottish Society has anything to do with it is because they're the ones sort of foiled the police in their cover-up initially.
Yeah, they want somebody to essentially hang for this. Right?
Yeah. So they hold Wong captive for something like 6 weeks, torturing him, trying to get him to confess, and he doesn't.
Yeah.
And finally, they decide to let him go. At this point, you know, people don't know who has done this. But it's later rumored that the Governor General has been aware of this happening the whole time and chooses to do nothing.
And the police chief as well.
And the police chief.
Yeah.
So they let Wong go. He's wandering around the streets. And the police immediately pick him up and arrest him for the murder of Janet Smith.
But nobody arrests anybody for kidnapping him or torturing him.
No, it slowly comes out that certain people are involved. A couple of them are police officers. I believe a couple of them are high society members.
Yeah.
They're basically just let off the hook. I mean, there's a lot of, like, legal steps and craziness that happen here. But essentially, the government steps in and stops anyone from really being prosecuted.
Yeah, so
even though they have kidnapped and tortured this man.
Yeah, like, there's one man that pleads guilty to it. A detective and his son are convicted of kidnapping Wong, but the jury doesn't actually
Do something weird, like they give them a sympathy.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called, but they're basically just like, oh, we don't want to convict you.
Essentially, it's called a strong recommendation of mercy.
Oh, like, what the fuck is that?
It's that discretionary, like, oh, your actions were justifiable. You know, you're torturing of somebody.
These racist 1920s people being like, he's just Chinese.
Exactly. Like, it doesn't matter. He's not. Well, and it's because at that time, you didn't view people of color as having the same rights as a white person.
Yeah, or maybe they thought he deserved it. Maybe they still thought he was the murderer.
Or, yeah. Well, and there's definitely a idea that we talked about already, the sort of, like, these barbaric ideas of racism. And so the idea that he either is a murderer because he doesn't have the capabilities to not be a murderer based on his racial origins, or the idea that it's just easy to blame him.
Yeah, so
like, regardless, Wong is, you know, he, at this point, they are in, you know, going to court. They are trying to build a case against him, but it's so, this whole thing has been so disorganized, and the evidence has been so fucked that they end up just having to drop the charges because they just don't have enough against him.
No, exactly. They have to drop everything. They have to let him go. He goes back to
Hong Kong.
I
mean, I would.
I would totally get out of here.
Yeah.
Whether I was guilty or not, I would get out of here. I would not want to risk getting kidnapped again, get put on trial again. I would get out of here. The one thing that is interesting to note back to the kidnapping is even though everybody's acquitted, the police chief, they do realize that he did know about it. And he did nothing about it.
He does get in trouble, doesn't he?
He does. His career is severely damaged because of that. And he no longer has the career projection that he would have had if he hadn't been involved in that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that has anything to do with the idea that he allowed the kidnapping of somebody in terms of, like, the racial ideas of it. I think it more has to do with the fact that he couldn't solve the case and that he resorted to allowing these things to happen.
So the whole thing just makes him look terrible.
It makes him look terrible, but I think it is way more to do with the fact that he couldn't solve the murder of this woman than it has to do with the...
Do you have the police chief's name in front of you there?
I believe his name is Mason.
That does sound right.
Yeah, it says Mason.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, at this point, really nobody else ever is brought forward as a suspect.
Not in any official circumstance.
No.
Like, there's rumors that fly around. There are new theories that have come up in recent years, but there is absolutely nobody else that gets looked at thoroughly.
So, at this point, I mean, the case is still unsolved. It has been fascinating people for decades.
Almost
100 years.
Yeah,
now.
Nearly a century now.
But there certainly is a lot of speculation and theories about what could have happened. And, you know, given the involvement and police cover up and corruption, I mean, it really, a lot of people, I think, now seem to think that it must have something to do with a high member of society.
Yeah, well, because there's no reason to cover it up and mishandle it, as we talked about this already. There's no reason to do that for Wong.
So the question is, you know, is it the Bakers, who, her employers, who are, you know, they hang out, it seems like they hang out with high society, but they're not necessarily themselves that high on the ladder.
No, they're...
But they have connections to people that are pretty high up there.
Yeah, they're very connected. They go to parties. They host parties with high society. So there's a lot of rumors about what might have happened. And they're friends with very powerful people, including some very powerful men. So there's some theories that there was a big party at their house that night. A lot of powerful men were there. And then there's this interesting theory based on that it could have been an orgy gone wrong.
Yeah, something about her, a husband and a wife, and she fell backwards and hit her head on a counter or a bathtub.
Exactly. And it could have been, they were talking about how it could have been the lieutenant governor's son who was an extreme playboy. I don't know if there's any evidence to actually support that, or if it's just...
But yeah, a popular theory was definitely that the Bakers had held a wild party, whether it was her employers, the Bakers, or his brother-in-law. I'm not 100% sure about that. And that she had been raped and murdered, which, you know, given the rushed embalming, which would have destroyed that kind of evidence.
Yeah.
You never know, but... They certainly would have effectively destroyed anything that would have pointed to sexual assault.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it kind of fits with a bit of what she was reporting in her journal, too. There is one point in her journal where she talks about how she thinks that the way that she will end up in a poor circumstance because of the way that she attracts men.
Or maybe the way that these prominent men are treating her.
Well, and that's where I think that's, like, where she's going.
Yeah.
Like, that is she's not, is she, there's just definitely some evidence in her diary that indicates that there were some interesting things that were going on.
Man, like, it would be so, starting with the rumors of, you know, there's slight rumors throughout this case of opium trade.
Yeah.
You know, partying politicians, like, to know what she would have potentially known.
Yeah.
And maybe that was it, too. Maybe she just knew a bunch of shit about these guys.
Oh, yeah, because they're saying that there's a potential that it was a drug trade gone wrong.
Yeah.
Too. But it could so easily be that she had some information. Perhaps mm-hmm. there was something going on in the house and she walked in on it.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps she knew something. I mean, there's even the possibility that she knew something and was threatening somebody mm-hmm. with it. Like, she could have been blackmailing somebody with that.
It could be so many things.
Information.
What are
so
these
many.
Black marks on her hands? I know they were trying to figure out if it had anything to do with opium.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation that it does.
Mm-hmm.
Because
so her boss, Fred Baker,
mm-hmm.
He was in the business of importing and exporting. I'm doing quotation marks right now. And I kind of, like, jokingly, whenever somebody lists their occupation as importing and exporting, like, I kind of just assume or jokingly assume that it is drugs.
Oh, yeah, me too. Me too. That's a very 90s assumption.
Yeah,
as
yeah.
Well.
I mean, of course, people legitimately import and export things, but just to label your job that way. So, yeah, it could have been him, could have been her boss.
Well, and the Vancouver police force was heavily tied up with the opium trade in around the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. So it's not that big of a stretch to say that it could have been that. And
yeah.
Especially when you look at the... I feel like either the police force is completely incompetent or is involved in a cover-up. Like, there's nothing in between.
It seems like the way that her case was initially handled seems very willfully, like they weren't doing their jobs on purpose. Because there was no, like, any good police officer or detective would have noticed the wound on the back of her head or her defensive wounds and said, this doesn't look like a suicide.
Like, nobody's that incompetent.
No.
Like, I'm not a police chief or a police officer, and I feel like if I went into a murder scene, I'd be like, oh, this looks suspicious.
And, yeah, I mean, like, where did the gun even come from? I'm sure, I feel like at some point, like, somebody who is so fluent in this case is going to email us and be like, actually, the gun was in the living room cabinet. But
well, like, to be honest, if they do that, I would love
yeah,
to
absolutely.
Talk to
if
them.
If you know more about this case than we do, because there's a million kind of hazy sources.
Oh, yeah.
Like, totally email us and tell us what you think.
We'd love to talk to you about it.
Absolutely.
Because, like, we both tried to read up on all the different theories. But, like, there's a novel that's written about mm-hmm. it. We talked with the police museum in Vancouver before. They actually did a talk on it in 2014.
And it's a part of the haunted tour.
Yeah.
Yeah, which one of our friends has done.
And we want to do.
Yeah, where they take you and they do a little bit of a tour around Mountain View Cemetery and maybe other places. I'm not sure. I haven't done it.
Yeah.
But they do talk about Janet Smith, the Scottish Nightingale.
She's a very interesting character.
I want to know where the Nightingale thing comes from, because I didn't come across anything about her being a singer.
No, and nothing about her being really, like, saintly or anything
yeah.
either, and so...
Like, it's a catchy title.
Yeah. Maybe it comes from the nanny side of it, and, like, the Florence Nightingale of being a...
Is she a nurse?
She's a nurse, but, like, you know, the caretaker side of that. I don't know. That could be it. There's so much, like, the KKK robes you've got.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty dramatic.
It was really dramatic.
I didn't even know that, I mean, is the KKK even a thing in Canada?
So, it is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Apparently, too, so remember when I was talking about how there's, like, that nanny that goes to see this reverend?
Yeah.
And he's the one that sort of gets the everybody talking about it. He wrote this magazine called The Beacon. It's a very sort of like religious magazine at this time.
Are you sure that's not a Jehovah's Witness pamphlet?
Well, I'm pretty sure I've seen that at the...
That's the Watchtower.
That is the Watchtower. So in The Beacon, it turns out that The Beacon is actually run by two leading members of the KKK from 1924 to 1930. Huh. So there is... definitely a link.
That is, I didn't find that at all. That's interesting.
I read this in an academic paper that I was reading.
Good job.
And they also said that the Beacon reported, so when Wong had been kidnapped, mm-hmm. the Beacon reported that he had fled.
Maybe all those police officers and detectives involved in kidnapping actually were KKK.
Maybe.
I just assumed that they were just costumes to be like, we're racist, we're stealing this Asian guy.
No, I think there was actually some KKK involvement.
Wow. That didn't even occur to me.
I
thought they were just trying to cover up their police actions.
No, I think it was a combination of both. Like, I think I read a really interesting take on it. It was more just not a theory, but it was just sort of describing it. And they talked about how, in a way, it was sort of like Canada's own version of To Kill a Mockingbird, with all of like the racism that was mm-hmm. attached to it and the theories that was attached to it. And then also that, you know, you take somebody who can't really, in a way, defend themselves because the way society has decided to view them. And that there's this, there's a legal case to it, but there's also mm-hmm. the violence. Mm-hmm. And so I can only imagine that the person who wound up defending Wong in court probably had to deal mm-hmm. with a lot of
different. Yeah, absolutely. I would be interested to know, like, that lawyer's part of side of the story too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's so many people that would have fascinating things to talk about.
Absolutely. I mean, this case is just a really, it's a sad and interesting snapshot of, you know, where Vancouver was at in the 1920s, I think.
Vancouver had a very, very dark period of time in the 1920s, and especially when it comes to policing and racism. As we talked about earlier, the immigration acts that got passed, BC was one of the leading advocates of making stricter or banning Chinese immigration, which is actually really interesting when you look especially at Vancouver nowadays, because Vancouver today is a very multicultural society, far more than many other cities.
Yeah, and our Asian population is such a big part of who we are.
And we really identify with that, and we're very Absolutely. Welcoming with that. And so it's really interesting to look back and see that really ugly history. And it's really interesting, too, because, like, why would you want to stay in British Columbia or in Vancouver?
I mean, I guess it depends where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm. And, like, dealing with what happens here could be better than what you have to face back home, which is also really...
But how can you know what you're in? Yeah, how can you know what you're in for when you get to a new city? But,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know, many of the Chinese immigrants stayed.
Yeah.
And like we were saying, I mean, it's such a big part of what our city is now.
We have a great Chinatown in Vancouver. Actually, mm-hmm. the police museum is just steps outside of Chinatown, and... It's a really, Vancouver's a very fascinating place to live. And when we look back to what the ugly history in Vancouver in terms of racism and policing.
Well, you can't ignore it.
You definitely can't ignore it. And as we were talking about earlier, like, I like that Vancouver actually does recognize where it came from and its faults. But, you know, like, just, it was like 20 years after this case, the police chief of Vancouver, it's not the same one as in the Janet Smith case, but in 1955, the police chief in Vancouver has to flee to Los Angeles because there's this sensational public inquiry saying that he's accepted bribes on all different kinds of cases.
Doesn't it kind of seem like prior to, like, I was about to say the 50s, but then I moved it up to, like, the 70s and then the 80s. But prior to a certain time, it just kind of was accepted that maybe police were dirty.
I think, well, and if it's not just in Vancouver, like, when you look at movies like The Departed, yeah. You know, yeah. It's police corruption was a huge part of so much North American history, and I'm sure European history as well.
Yeah, it's another topic that we could just go on and on.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, so, you know, just to wrap up here, do you think that there's any way that this case would ever actually be solved?
I mean, unless you find
a new piece of evidence.
A new piece of evidence. And you're never going to find any physical evidence on her.
If only she'd written more in her journal.
Yeah, I mean, like, it would be so hard, too, at this time. I'm sure there's ways we'd be able to prove that something that we found was legitimate or not with all of, like, the carbon dating and technology we have.
Look, what happened to the gun? If the cops got a hold of it, they would have wiped it down and gotten rid of it or whatever, but...
Yeah...
I don't know if I could ever work in that field because not being able to solve a puzzle.
Oh, it would drive me crazy. I always wish, like, there's part of me, and I don't know if that's just my obsession with watching crime dramas on television. I always wanted to be a police detective because I just thought it would be so fun. But I feel like, I mean, also in Vancouver, there's not a lot of murders that aren't gang-related in modern-day Vancouver.
Yeah. Things have changed.
Things have changed. There's not a lot of those, like, sensational crimes like this that happen. So I feel like it would be kind of boring here. But it would be definitely really hard to work in a field where you can't solve everything. And it haunts people. I mean, I'm basing all of my facts on the television shows that I have watched, and I've seen all of those detectives go crazy or get very damaged because they can't solve cases. There's always that case that haunts them.
Well, you know, I'm just gonna, like, cheers to Janet Smith.
Cheers to Janet Smith.
Yeah. I hope your last night at least was super fun.
Hopefully you had a good orgy.
Oh, no, that's in terrible taste.
Let's not. Let's cut that part out.
No, I'm going to leave it in.
No!
So leaving that in. Well, that pretty much wraps it up for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And once again, of course, if you have any ideas for us or any feedback, especially if it has to do with local history, we'd love to hear it. Please email us at thetipsyarchives@gmail.com. And thanks again. Bye.